We are talking once again with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. It's been a dull week. Nothing much going on.
It's going to be tough to fill an hour this week, but we're going to try. Starting out with, and I don't think there's anything laughable in the content we're covering today, but no. But starting out with local, beginning with the mayor's new budget.
Yeah, this week Mayor Durkin released her 2021 budget to the city and to the city council. First of all, I want to say Durkin based her budget on the original 2020 budget before COVID-19 hit, not on the changes that the city council passed in August and then reaffirmed in September when they overrode Durkin's veto. This means that all of the major changes that the council made, Durkin has completely reversed in her 2021 budget, including
which just means the council is going to redo right. Those changes.
Well, it means they have to redo all that work, and that includes restore. You know, Durkin restored the navigation team. She restored cuts to the Seattle Police Department budget. She neglects to continue the $14 million funding.
Wait a minute. You mean she didn't. She didn't include cuts to the budget.
Yes.
You said she restored the cuts.
She restored anything that was cut out of the Seattle Police Department budget. She just takes it back to the beginning of 2020 and says, that's what we're working from. Okay, we're not going to work from the cuts that the city council are trying to make at the end of 2020. And then she didn't continue the $14 million funding for community public safety solutions that the council was a big piece of what the council passed in August, or the $3 million for participatory budgeting that doesn't continue into 2021. She deems them one-time expenditures, and that if the city council wants to continue that work, then they need to, you know, They need to find a source of money for that because Mayor Durkin's not going to do it. So that was a huge slap in the face to the city council. Now, the big question everybody's had is, did the mayor make any cuts at all to the Seattle Police Department? And the answer is no, not at all. She moved three mostly civilian units out of the Seattle Police Department, parking enforcement, which she transferred to the Department of Transportation, the Office of Emergency Management, and the 911 Communications Center, which she moved into their own new departments within the budget. Her budget makes a small cut to staffing by reducing overtime and placing a hiring freeze on civilian jobs within the SPD. So any vacancies that are there now are just not going to be filled. That's what she's done. But those are really the only positions that are cut. No sworn officers lose their jobs in this budget. And looking at it, I noticed she did make one concession to something that the city council had tried to do. She breaks out the operations by precinct for 2021. So you can see where, okay, the personnel, the vacancies that are not going to be filled, where are they? Which precinct? And can you guess which precinct will have the vast majority of those positions cut? Can you guess?
No.
I would say east, but I don't know.
No, it's the southwest precinct, which is Lisa Leopold's district. So it's almost like, you know, you look at this budget and it's like looking at, you know, a couple of grade school kids fighting, you know, Durkin.
I only see one grade school kid there.
Yeah, exactly. And Durkin goes a step further by setting up two new groups in her budget to study policy changes and how to, you know, quote unquote, reshape community safety and policing. Both of those groups will be staffed solely by current city employees, including members of the Seattle Police Department. They would essentially be doing work, and I just want to point out, they would essentially be doing work that the city council and the council staff, central staff, did this summer when they opened up the black box of the Seattle Police Department budget and found that there were a lot of departments that could be cut or could be civilianized. Durkin, however, wants to do her own work on that, and she wants her own hand-picked crew to help her make those decisions. So obviously she's not going to accept the conclusions that the city council reached in August.
I think a blue ribbon commission is in order.
I know. Durkin, just like her predecessors, has been known for wanting to set up her own blue ribbon commission to study things to death and to be staffed by her own handpicked people.
And hopefully in 2022, there will be a new mayor to do that all over again.
Yeah, we'll see. Now, as for the city budget as a whole, there are cuts to most departments, which is something we could expect in a recession. And at first, it looks like the one exception to that is the Human Services Department. Initially, it looks like the department gets an overall 14% increase or a boost of $33 million. But when you dig deeper into the details, this is what you find. You find that of that $33 million increase, $23 million is a one-time federal grant to house the homeless population during the COVID-19 pandemic, and $10 million is from the city's reserve funds for COVID-19 relief for small businesses, child care providers, people experiencing hunger or having difficulty paying rent or mortgage payments, and immigrants and refugees. So it's one-time funding that the city council had already worked during the summer to try to allocate and a big federal grant that the city received from the U.S. government. So the total increase is attributable to those things. It's not attributable to Durkin saying, oh, these are new programs or this is new ongoing funding. In addition, the Human Services Department budget includes $2 million for the mayor's handpicked team to reimagine policing and public safety. And the mayor's budget cuts 11 jobs from the Human Services Department. Now, most of them are already vacant positions, or they will fall vacant because of retirements. But some involve work that's being transferred to the new King County Homelessness Agency. Now, the city entered into that agreement to participate in the King County Homelessness Authority. Durkin's 2021 budget gives us the first picture of how much that's going to cost the city of Seattle. In 2021, she estimates about $114 million. Now, the city spent about $95 million last year on homelessness programs. So moving to a regional authority is costing the city of Seattle an extra $19 million, or a 20% increase over what it costs to keep those services in-house. So,
and we have no evidence that it's actually going to improve homelessness services.
Yeah. So you could say that it might be getting a boost because the agency needs money to get started, but that was in last year's budget. That money to get the regional authority all up and running was in last year's budget. This is the ongoing expenses, and it's not looking good. Now, weirdly, Durkin cut funding out of the HSD budget, the human services budget, for the navigation team, the civilian members of the navigation team. But she said that she wants to, again, use that word, reimagine, and perhaps rename the navigation team. So I think what she's actually done is she's cut the number of staff and the money for the navigation team, and instead she's renamed it and included it in a new line in the budget called Unsheltered Outreach and Response. Last year, the budget for 13 civilian members of the navigation team within the Human Services Department was about $2.5 million. The budget for the new 8-person team, fewer people, right, is $7.5 million. So not only did she change the name of it and move it to a new line in the budget, she just decided to, let's just triple the budget for it. So again, you know, you have a feeling, you have the sense that it's like a little kid saying, I'm going to try to squirrel away my favorite project and not let the city council be able to find it. In the meantime, I'll just triple the budget.
And rename it because the current program has gotten so much bad publicity.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Now, Durkin has been boasting that she's investing $100 million in BIPOC communities. And I can see that $100 million in a new Equitable Communities Initiative budget line, which she stuck in the Finance General section of the budget. Not in the Human Services Department, not in the Public Safety section of the budget, which means because it's sitting in the Finance General section, it means that Durkin hasn't identified anything to spend it on yet. She hasn't identified any programs. She hasn't allocated it between different projects or anything. And how she's going to be doing that in the future is a huge open question that she and her handpicked teams will want to be working on. And they don't want the city council to have any input on that, or apparently communities, by not allocating it to any programs.
Maybe she'll give it all to Andre Taylor to spend.
Yeah, she's essentially asking the city council to write her a big blank check. And I don't think the city council is going to want to do that. So we'll see what they say about that $100 million boost in the Finance General portion of the budget.
You mean the majority people of color council isn't going to trust the older white woman to spend the money for them?
Yeah. Now, yeah, exactly. Now, there are two departments that are cut deeply. And it's two departments that manage some of the city's most important assets and infrastructure, the Parks Department and the Transportation Department. For the Parks Department, it means less maintenance and upkeep for existing parks, trails, and park facilities at a time, really, when that's the one public amenity that people are using the most under COVID-19 restrictions, right? Because people can be outdoors. They can't gather indoors. And I'm seeing that even in my own neighborhood, that I see people out going for walks. I see them in the park a lot. Now, within the parks budget, Durkin is transferring millions out of the capital budget into operations to keep the parks and parks facilities like community centers, swimming pools. I think the city has something like 12 swimming pools, and the city's four golf courses at least minimally maintained. The capital budget takes a 39% cut, which means a delay in needed upgrades to parks and recreational facilities, as well as acquisition of new parks and improvements to our existing parks. Given that land owned and managed by the Parks Department makes up about 12% of all Seattle land area, this is a huge cut, and it could affect everything from upgrading play fields to upgrades at major parks like the Seattle Center, the zoo, the aquarium, the arboretum, and the new downtown waterfront park and its piers, which are decaying. You say parks, you know, and you think green spaces like Woodland Park or Jefferson Park, Ravenna Park or Discovery Park, right? But it's those big gathering spaces with facilities too. And it's also places like the city's beaches, like Golden Gardens, Alki Beach, Seward Park, Lincoln Park, Magnuson Park, Green Lake. You start thinking about it, and you think about all the hundreds of little pocket parks around the city that people are using all the time with dog runs and children's playground areas. And you have to remember that we're called the Emerald City for a reason. So cutting capital projects and improvements and large replacements and repairs is a big deal, actually.
Also, don't the parks make up a significant percentage of the restrooms that are tagged as places that the homeless can go?
Yeah, that has been a big controversy over the last year, is that with the COVID-19 shutdowns and a big hole in the city budget, one of the first things that the mayor decided and that the city parks department did was they closed a lot of restrooms in the parks, and that pushed a whole lot of homeless people away from where they usually go to, you know, relieve themselves and to wash.
Which, in the middle of a pandemic, is a huge issue.
Is a huge issue. Yes, yes, it is. And like I say, the parks are being used not just by the homeless, but by everybody, because it's the one place you can go that's relatively safe, right? Now, the other asset-heavy department that takes a big cut is the Seattle Department of Transportation, which means there's going to be a lot of delays in a whole bunch of important projects, including repaving and filling potholes, seismic.
And they've already got a huge backlog in maintenance.
Huge
years and years.
Yeah, it's going to mean delays to seismic upgrades to what they call non-critical bridges. And I'm not sure, I guess that must mean the current quality of those bridges, because I can't imagine any bridge being considered non-critical for the city's infrastructure. So it's going to mean cuts in support for bike share, car share, and carpools. Cuts in projects in the pedestrian master plan, including new sidewalks in North and South Seattle and crossing upgrades and support for Vision Zero. Cuts in projects in the bicycle master plan, including protected bike lanes and building out the downtown bike lane network. Cuts in neighborhood greenway projects, including expansion of the Burke-Gilman Trail. Cuts in support for transit projects. Cuts and delays in commercial transportation projects, including improvements to freight corridors, improvements on West Marginal Way that are needed now because of the closure of the West Seattle Bridge, and signal improvements on arterial streets, and delays to the rebuild of the Alaskan Way and a pedestrian bridge for the new waterfront park. And even with all those cuts, Durkin's budget includes $66.3 million in new bonds or loans, essentially, in order to cover operating costs for the Seattle Department of Transportation. In comparison, the city issued $14.5 million in bonds last year and $19.2 million in transportation bonds the year before. So $66.3 million is more than three times the usual amount of borrowing for transportation projects. And typically when you issue bonds for transportation projects, it's for capital projects to build or to maintain or to repair or replace something like a bridge. It's not typically for operations, ongoing operations. So this is kind of a desperation budget for the Seattle Department of Transportation. One thing I want to point out, though, is that her transportation budget doesn't take into account that in November, voters will have a chance to decide whether or not to renew the Seattle Transportation Benefit District. And if that passes, there will be a lot more money available to fill these holes in the transportation budget, because this budget doesn't take into account that that levy could pass.
So two questions. Mm-hmm. One, will the council have enough time to incorporate that information after November 3rd, given that they'll try to have the final budget ready by the end of the month?
I think they will try.
And the second question is, do you have a sense, I don't know if you have this handy, but do you have a sense of how much the revenue loss was because of COVID this year compared to 2020?
Well, the August revenue, I don't have a sense of the overall loss. I know that it's not as bad as initially feared that it would be, and that's true statewide. I know the state budget is seeing perhaps half the revenue loss that they had anticipated. And that's because of the strength and diversity of our economy here in Western Washington in particular. But also, we're operating, Durkin's budget was based on August estimates of revenue losses. Now, the city council, once they start working on the budget, they will get a new revenue forecast here pretty soon that takes into account what the city has been able to collect in September through September of this year. And that will give the city's budget folks a chance to refine their revenue forecasts for next year. And it may show that there's actually more money available than Durkin's budget has within it. And my guess is that parks and transportation are two of the places where the city council may allocate more funding.
Yeah, I would, number one, I would think parks is tremendously popular and they're going to get a lot of pushback on that.
Yeah, and they already have started to get quite a bit of pushback on that. Because it's everything. I mean, it's ball fields, it's community centers, it's, you know, take the kids to the swimming pool, you know, it's all sorts of things.
Durkin has to know that, because mm-hmm. she has to know that people are incredibly passionate about their local parks.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But I think it was, you know, just it, her She said that her budget was written with the idea that she wanted to preserve as many jobs within the city government as she could. And to do that, you have to preserve operations. And to do that, you have to say, okay, the money we typically spend on capital projects, new projects, and replacements, we just need to not spend that next year and just move that over to operations. And where do you do that? Where's that money mostly spent? It's spent in a couple of places within the budget where the city owns most of its assets. And that's either city facilities or its parks and its transportation. So
right,
it's really kind of a desperation budget in a way. But I just kind of wanted to point out there that in a recession like we're having, you know, these recessions, and you say, you know, oh, well, maybe it'll make state and local governments leaner and meaner, and they'll find efficiencies within their budget. That's the Republican stand on this. And why the Republicans in Congress won't allocate money to state and local governments and are holding up a second COVID-19 relief bill at the national level because they don't want to provide any money to state and local governments. But that ignores the fact that a lot of these state and local governments are pretty lean and mean, but they also have these assets that need to be taken care of, right, that are incredibly and enormously popular and that are used by just about everybody within the city. And this is the kind of budget that you get in that sort of a year when you're not getting any assistance from the federal government.
All right. So, well, let's move on to this week's SPD Seattle Police Department news related.
Yeah. Yeah. A couple things. On Wednesday, the ACLU of Washington asked U.S. District Court Judge Richard Jones to hold the city of Seattle and the Seattle Police Department in contempt of his temporary restraining order against using less lethal weapons against peaceful protesters in Seattle. Now, the ACLU had filed a similar motion earlier this summer after the protest on July 25th on Capitol Hill, in which the Seattle Police Department attacked a large crowd of peaceful demonstrators with flashbang grenades, pepper balls, pepper spray, and rubber bullets. This week's filing provided evidence that the Seattle Police Department has been continuing to attack demonstrators in the months since then, including a candlelight vigil at the Washington State Patrol headquarters in Eastlake on August 26th. Where Seattle cops broke car windows and used pepper spray on people who had lit some small candles and were talking peacefully. In addition, video evidence and testimony was presented of a Seattle Police Department attack against a much larger protest at the Seattle Police Officers Guild Hall on September 7th, and another attack on a smaller protest on September 22nd. And that was the day the city council overrode the mayor's veto of the 2020 city budget, which included cuts to the police department. On that night, a couple of videos were posted showing a Seattle Police Department officer deliberately walking and rolling his bicycle over the head and neck of a demonstrator laying on the ground. In its filing this week, the ACLU claimed that the SPD's attacks are retaliatory, meaning not just used to control or disperse a crowd, or even just to violate the demonstrators' free speech rights, which is bad enough, right? But to actually punish protesters for even attempting to exercise those rights. Further, the ACLU says that it has asked the city of Seattle, including the mayor's office and the city attorney's office, to exercise some control over the SPD and bring an end to these attacks, but the city has done nothing so far. The city replied to the motion on Friday, saying that the Seattle Police Department was completely justified in attacking demonstrators at these protests, and gave reasons that were easily refuted by the ACLU. For example, that protesters at the candlelight vigil had blocked a nearby fire station with their cars, when in fact it was Seattle Police Department officers who had blocked access to the fire station. And you can see that on the video, in the video evidence. And for the protest at the Seattle Police Officers Guild headquarters, the city said that the SPD had intel at that time that protesters were going to use Molotov cocktails, but then didn't provide any credible evidence of that. No.
And there's no history of that.
No, and there's no history of that. Now, the same is true for another demonstration in September. The city said that SPD was responding to people throwing rocks, cans, and bottles. Although, to be clear, and this is seen on video evidence as well, those things are invariably thrown after the SPD begins gassing and assaulting people. In one case, the city said SPD was responding to intel that someone in the crowd had said something about, quote unquote, doing some cooking, which they thought was very concerning. And that's just absolutely preposterous.
I was watching that particular SPOG march.
Yeah.
SPD attacked the march while they were marching down the street and there was no police presence. So, I mean, they came out of nowhere and just swooped in. So the idea that the crowd was throwing stuff, was physically impossible. There was nobody to throw it at. And they were doing, they were walking down the street. It was totally peaceful. There were families there with their kids. And suddenly SPD decided to gas the crowd and drive them back. Mm-hmm. It was completely unprovoked.
Yeah. Yeah. And it, time after time after time when you watch
yep.
these videos.
Yep.
Now, Judge Jones has not ruled on the motion yet, but he probably will next week or the week after he's had a chance to review all the evidence. Now, the other thing I want to talk about that happened this week, there was movement in the other court case, too, the one before U.S. District Court Judge James Robart, who placed a temporary restraining order earlier this year on the Seattle City Council's ban on crowd control weapons, because he thought it might be in violation of the consent decree. This week, the City of Seattle teamed up with the U.S. Department of Justice to ask Judge Robart to convert the restraining order into a preliminary injunction while they begin a process of reviewing SPD's crowd control and use of force policies with the new court-appointed monitor, who's replacing Merrick Bob, and making changes under the provisions of the consent decree, according to how the consent decree says they're supposed to do this kind of thing. Now, the city presented this as an opportunity to take the recommendations of the three oversight bodies, the Office of Police Accountability, the Office of the Inspector General of the SPD, and the Community Police Commission, and then use their recommendations and revise SPD's policies accordingly by following the steps laid out by the consent decree. Robart agreed with that notion, and he granted the motion. So now the city must come up with a timeline and a plan for making changes to those policies, and it will have to take input from the new court monitor, the Department of Justice, the three oversight bodies, and I would hope from the city council, too. But that's not guaranteed, since Durkin is going to be in charge of this process on the city's side. Now, the good news is that the city is finally taking this seriously, finally. The bad news is that Robart won't be ruling on the city council's ban of crowd control weapons until this process is finished, and it could take months. Or the city council could, and this is what their response could be, because their lawyers were not involved this week in this discussion between the city and the court. The city council could eventually revisit that ban and make changes to it that match whatever new policies the city negotiates with the court monitor and the DOJ, or that could match the recommendations in these three reports that were issued by the three oversight bodies. And I think that would not be a bad outcome necessarily. So we'll see how the city council responds, and we'll see what the city comes up with in terms of a timeline for making changes to SPD's crowd control policies. And then we'll also follow very closely what those proposed changes will be.
Yep.
All right.
So a couple of important things that yep. happened this week.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. Moving on, it appears and was announced that Boeing is moving more of its production out of state.
Yeah, and prize. The Everett plant, which is where the 787 was supposed to be produced, is they're instead going to move it to Charleston, South Carolina, which is non-union labor, which is what Boeing has steadily been doing over the last couple of decades. And once again, it reminds us of the last minute huge tax amelioration package that was passed by the state legislature at Boeing's specific request about a decade ago that cost state taxpayers billions of dollars for jobs that are steadily been disappearing. These kind of corporate welfare packages often tend to result in that. And it's been very predictable because Boeing is not a hometown corporation. They have not been for a couple of decades since they moved their headquarters to Chicago in 2001, nearly 20 years ago. Local legislators still seem to react that way. Certainly the Seattle Times covers them as though they were still a tiny little hometown company rather than one of the largest corporations in the world.
They do that for Amazon too.
Yes, they do. And Microsoft. Yeah, all these big companies that have the state legislature on the speed dial. So yeah, that's going to be a hit to the local economy for sure. And we'll see what kind of job loss that results in. But it's a major impact on the city of Everett and Snohomish County for their economy for sure.
All right. Also this week, a Proud Boy was arrested.
Yeah, a guy named Alan Swinney, who has been notorious, particularly in Portland, for attacking protesters there. He had 12 warrants out for him, and he was finally arrested this week. So one down, many to go. People are rightly concerned, especially after the Proud Boys specifically were called out in the debate this week, which we'll get to in a minute. Proud Boy presence has been somewhat of an issue in Seattle, but much more of an issue in Portland, where they've really been targeting those demonstrations, and people have been, and live streamers in particular, have had death threats and been assaulted quite a bit. Swinney was responsible for a fair number of those attacks, and now he is being charged with those attacks. He's in jail on rather high bond. And we'll see how that proceeds and how the prosecution against him goes forward. Keep an eye on that.
All right. Moving on to national, and I think it was last weekend when the New York Times broke the story.
Yes, it was. It first showed up Saturday night, shortly after our show. And then on Sunday, they did. They found the holy grail of journalism over the last 4 years, which was Trump's taxes for the last 15 years. And in 10 of those 15 years, he had not paid any tax at all. For 2016, 2017, he had only paid $750 for each of those years, which that would be the equivalent for my income of paying about 3 cents. I actually did the math.
Can I point out too that the New York Times pointed out that the last couple of years when he paid $750 in tax, he could have paid zero tax, but it looks like his accountants had decided not to declare all of his losses so that he would actually owe some small amount of tax.
Yes, so mm-hmm. so his estate won't have to pay any taxes either. He had claimed during the campaign in 2016 that he couldn't release his taxes because they were being audited. Well, it looks like they were being audited, and for good reason, because it looks like, the IRS certainly flagged his tax returns for a lot of, shall we say, creative accounting.
I think the issue is that, he claims he's a very, very, very successful businessman, but his tax returns show year after year after year of him pouring cash into these properties that are losing money hand over fist. And he has taken out a lot of loans, Unfortunately, on tax returns, you don't know where those loans came from.
And yeah, that remains an open question.
Yeah, in order to pour even more cash into his businesses, and that those loans appear to be due in the next couple of years, 2 to 3 years, and the loans total something like $300 million, which could wipe out a significant chunk of his assets.
And he has personally guaranteed those loans also.
Yeah. Yeah, so he's got an enormous business empire, but he's mismanaged it terribly, and he is not a great businessman.
And the real takeaway from this is it's a serious national security issue, because we don't know where those loans came from. According to Eric Trump a few years ago, they have an unlimited line of credit from Russia, which might explain why he's so solicitous of Vladimir Putin. If he's got those kind of loans coming up, and that is a huge national security issue. You don't want the President of the United States having a huge personal debt to a foreign adversary. And that kind of money had to go through Putin. That's the way Russia and their oligarchs and Putin's kleptocracy is structured. So, you know, we still don't know where his personal debts are. But potentially they're a huge national security issue, and yeah, it would explain a lot about Trump's foreign policy and why he's been so solicitous of a country that is interfering in our elections, that is putting a bounty on our soldiers in Afghanistan, and that clearly has been trying to sow disinformation and sow conflict in the United States, quite successfully, I might add.
Mm-hmm. All right. Anything else on that?
No, let's move along. We got a couple other huge stories this week.
Let's move on.
Okay. There was a debate on Tuesday that we had announced here.
I think the term debate could be used very loosely. And I want to point out something that hasn't gotten a lot of attention about Trump's behavior in that debate. I mean, granted, it was horrific, it was boorish, it was bullying, all the rest of that. But it was very strategic. And we can understand why. Trump has been trying to make the case to his followers that Biden is senile, that he doesn't have all his faculties, etc. Joe Biden has a stutter. He's had it all his life. He's managed to overcome it in public speaking. Obviously, he's been in public life for decades. But he still has the stutter. And one of the ways to trigger a stutter in a person who is sort of trained to overcome it, abusive tone of voice, rapid fire interruptions, zigzagging changes of topic, personal insults and humiliations, mentioning family pain. Those are all tripwires for people who stutter. And it's well understood medically. So what Trump was trying to do was take advantage of a disability in behalf of Joe Biden. He was trying to take advantage of that and, you know, twist that into a different narrative that Biden is somehow stupid or senile or has dementia, et cetera. It was even more vile behavior than was understood on the surface, because that's what he was trying to do.
It really came across as Donald Trump acting like a little kid on the playground attacking grandpa. That's really what it looked like. And he didn't win a lot if he was trying to win any new followers or if he was trying to get votes in swing states. It did not win anybody really over to his side. And you can see it in the polls. I mean, going into the debates, there were still some questions as to whether some swing states would go Trump or Biden after the debate. And especially in the top quality nonpartisan polls, Trump lost a whole bunch of states to Biden from that performance.
And I would say specifically that the area that's being contested in terms of the sort of few undecided voters that were left is suburban women.
Yeah.
Those were the people who voted for Trump in 2016 and voted for Democrats in 2018. And you want to have a performance that really efficiently alienates suburban women? That was it. Because guess what? Suburban women don't like bullies. most women don't like bullies. A lot of people don't like bullies.
Yeah, and so, they recognize that behavior really fast, you know, having a lot of them having raised kids, they recognize a bully like right away. But yeah, and then, you know, after Trump's diagnosis, which we'll talk about here in a second, I also looked at the polls too. And what we're finding, is I think the reason why Trump was kind of desperate to try to make Biden fail in his performance is that there's no clear, route for Trump to win the electoral vote, according to the polls.
And that's also why he's trying to set up the Supreme Court, because he's given up on trying to convince people. He's just hoping that he can, invalidate votes and force, state legislatures to not certify electors and then throw the whole thing into the courts by Salem chaos.
Yeah. So what I find interesting is I still see people and still hear people saying that Trump could win in November. And I'm like, no, he can't. There really is not a way for him to win. The states that he has locked up make up about 107 electoral votes, and he needs 270 to win. And to get the rest of those votes, he needs like a dozen more states to come out strongly.
And also people say, well, the polls were wrong in 2016. They weren't wrong by this much.
No, not by this much.
It's a pretty solid baked-in lead for Biden at this point.
Yeah.
And people are already voting. There's already been at least 3 million people who've already voted. So that's happening in a lot of states. We will get our ballots in another week and a half, and we'll analyze what's on the ballots then, because it's not just a presidential race. But, you know, a lot of states are going to be voting while Trump is still in the hospital, and he really can't do much to change the dynamic of the race at this point.
Yeah, and I think what's even more interesting and not getting much press is the down ballot races. So the races for the Senate in key states flipped this week too, so that a lot of very, very close races are now polling heavily for the Democrats. And that's a response directly to the debate on Tuesday, I think.
Yeah, it is. Mm-hmm. And to the fact that for all of these, you know, horrible behaviors by Trump, the Republicans in those Senate races refuse to condemn him. And people like Joni Ernst and Martha McSally and some of those folks are doubling down on their support of Trump. And that's just not polling well.
Yeah, no, it's not. And you really have to look at how he did in the debate. The fact that during that debate, he criticized Biden for wearing a mask, and then not three days later.
Actually, probably just
the next day. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. So we'll get to that.
Shall we get into talking about that?
So there was a press conference this morning with Trump's doctors and some people from the White House talking about Trump's hospitalization. And it turns out that he tested positive for COVID-19, quote, 72 hours ago, which would put it Wednesday morning, the morning after the debate, which was about 36 hours before the public was told. We definitely know that Hope Hicks, who was the first person who was announced to have tested positive for COVID, was found to be positive on Thursday morning. So they sat on that for a number of hours also. And, you know, just given the history of this White House, people have a lot of suspicion of whether they're getting a straight story from Trump's doctors and from the officials in the White House. An anonymous official told the press pool after the formal briefing that Trump's vital signs were, quote unquote, concerning. And there's a lot of suspicion, especially on the left, that his prognosis is much more dire than has been led on. Usually you would not have an onset of symptoms that quickly after a test diagnosis. Usually it's 5 to 7 days. And you usually wouldn't hospitalize somebody that quickly, although that could be just preventative because it is the president of the United States. So there are a lot of questions. Many of those questions, I think, will be answered this weekend.
He is in the high risk category. You know, he's very much so. 74. He's heavily overweight.
And he has other pre-existing conditions also. He has a terrible diet. He doesn't exercise that much, except maybe for golfing. You know, it's he's he does he not takes, have a healthy lifestyle, and he has a job that's extremely high stress.
We know so. That he takes cholesterol medication, and his doctor said that he was taking a cocktail of drugs, and then he listed what the drugs were, and most of them are just vitamins like zinc and vitamin D, although I don't know why he's taking vitamin D when he gets lots of that from, you know, being out on his golf courses. But, you know, he's taking a daily aspirin. Okay. And here's the deal. Doctors are not, they don't just dispense and say anymore that you should take a daily aspirin just for overall health if you're over 50 years old anymore, because it can negatively impact your digestive tract. So what doctors tell people now is you take a daily aspirin if you've had a stroke, if you've had a heart attack, or if you have coronary artery disease. So I just want to ask, Trump, is there something you want to announce to us?
Yeah. And there's also he also got an antibody treatment, which has not even been authorized for emergency use yet by
still
the
being
FDA.
Studied. Yeah, still
yeah,
being
studied. Yeah, there is some evidence, but it's basically only anecdotal evidence and very small trials at this point that it might help with early symptoms of COVID infection. But, you know, the bottom line is he's at very high risk. At the same time, you're getting another major developing story. It looks like the way this was spread, that there were two major events. And then there was the debate prep, which was held indoors and which involved Hope Hicks and involved Chris Christie,
who also tested positive. Yeah.
And there was that. Which, you know, Christie probably coached him on how to be a bully. But the other event was the official nomination ceremony last Saturday for, Amy Coney Barrett for the Supreme Court. And the reason this is key is that there have been several people from that event, which there was no social distancing. There were no masks. It was held outdoors, but people mingled a lot. They hugged, et cetera. And two of the Republican members of the Senate Judiciary Committee who were at the first row in that event, Mike Lee from Utah, and then
Tom
Tillis of North Carolina, have tested positive also. So if they're self-isolating, they say they're going to isolate for 10 days. And then Lindsey Graham, who's the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, has said he's going to start hearings on Monday, I believe it's the 14th. So that would be right after they came back. But 10 days generally is not enough, especially if you have symptoms. It should be a minimum of 2 weeks. Yeah, it's 2 weeks that you can continue to spread the disease, even if you're asymptomatic. So, and if they have symptoms, as Trump obviously has had and as Melania has had, they're going to be out longer. That takes away the Republican majority from the Senate Judiciary Committee. And, assuming that the Democrats all hold firm and none of them get sick, and for that matter, none of the other Republicans, there were four others on that Judiciary Committee who are also at Barrett's, celebration and also in the first couple rows. That would be Mike Crapo of, Idaho,
Yeah, names are not important.
Yeah, there are four of them.
But the key Republican contingent on the Senate Judiciary Committee was there to welcome the new candidate, and that almost no one was wearing masks, and it became something like a super spreader event is pretty emblematic of what this White House has been about. You know, very cavalierly making fun of people who are trying to stay safe during the pandemic, of not following the recommendations of their own CDC. It was really just a matter of time before something like this happened.
Yeah, and you really have had, I think there now have been 8 people and counting who are infected with COVID who are at Amy Coney Barrett's ceremony, including
yeah, and what
the,
I
the what chair of the RNC, yeah. You know, et cetera, et cetera.
So, who also tested positive. Yeah,
the campaign manager for Trump's reelection campaign. So, they've all tested positive. And, you know, this, as Maria said, it's emblematic of, you know, people following the lead of Trump, who's been, not only dismissive of, but abusive of masks or take other basic public health, precautions. This was a matter of time before something like this was going to happen.
And so it's also raised, succession questions too. If Trump is seriously ill, or if he does fall very seriously ill, Mike Pence would have to step up. But Pence was at that same super spreader event and has been in contact with Trump since. He has so far tested negative, but, you know, that could change.
Yeah, and it will take a couple, three more days before we know those folks are in the clear, because it can take up to 5 days for a positive test to come out after you've been exposed.
Yeah,
so this weekend is going to be key.
Yeah, and then there's the vice presidential debate on Wednesday. So hopefully he will be testing negative right up till that event, and we'll be able to see an actual debate, even though it's the two down ballot candidates.
And I am looking forward to Kamala Harris, because she is an exceptionally good debater.
Mm-hmm. She is.
So we'll see how Pence responds to her.
Yeah.
I suspect that's going to be, you know, get your popcorn ready.
Yeah. Now, the Presidential Debate Committee said that, quote, additional tools to maintain order, end quote, will be in place for this coming debate. So we'll see what that means. I don't know what it is.
I hope they'll be able to kill mics when people interrupt.
That's what I'm hoping too.
And, you know, ideally, if somebody interrupts, I would love to see a trapdoor open. but yes, killing the mic was something many of us were screaming at our TV screens last Tuesday night.
Yeah, and so we can look forward to that on Wednesday at 6 p.m. Pacific time. That's going to be held at the University of Utah. Susan Page of USA Today, she was their White House correspondent for decades and is now their Washington, D.C. bureau chief. She'll be the moderator. And I'm sure she'll have some really good questions to ask. So that could be a pretty good debate. I only wish these were the top two candidates, not the second string.
Well,
candidates.
One of them may be the president by then.
Unfortunately.
And, you know, Pence has his own series of problems, starting with the fact that he's a Christian dominionist. But yes, it's a very, very fluid situation right now.
Yeah.
All right. Did you want to, want to talk more about COVID developments for this week, or?
Yeah, sure. We saw a Washington Post analysis this week that the recession caused by the COVID analysis is the most unequal in modern U.S. history. And a lot of the reason is that a lot of the jobs that have been impacted are service sector jobs rather than construction and manufacturing, which is where recessions have historically hit hardest. So we have seen, for example, the rebound in jobs since the peak unemployment in late spring has primarily been in the white collar jobs and among white people. The recovery for people of color has lagged significantly. Blacks have only recovered at one third of the jobs that whites have. For Latinx people, it's been even less. Young adults have lagged, women, young mothers in particular, both because they have trouble finding childcare and because women in general have lagged, and people without college degrees. Now, those are all service sector heavy jobs. Low wage jobs were lost at about eight times the rate of higher wage ones. White collar jobs have mostly recovered. So when Trump has said we've had a great recovery for the high income people that he's concerned about, he's right. But for most of the rest of us, that has not been correct at all. As I mentioned last week, I think, nearly half of, black-owned small businesses have closed. And that was just through the end of April, but it has not significantly recovered since then. So it has been a serious problem. Meanwhile, COVID is spiking in a number of states, some 33 states. It's been going up. Several states this week set one-day records for new cases, including Utah, North Dakota, Montana, Tennessee, a couple of other states in the Sun Belt are peaking. North Carolina is peaking. So we're starting to see a serious uptick now that people, the weather is getting cooler and people are moving indoors, especially back east. So, we are not out of the woods yet for COVID by any means. We have seen modeling that, by mid-November, we're going to have some 240,000 dead in the United States, that the death toll is going to significantly increase once again. And then, we're seeing globally, serious upticks in a number of cases. India reached 100,000 dead, just yesterday, continues to have the worst pandemic in the world in terms of daily counts and, daily death tolls. But the United States is creeping up as well. Trump is not the only one. So be careful. And we are seeing, numbers creep up again in Western Washington as well. So be aware of that, and don't think it's over by any means.
Yeah, and I want to point out to people that I think a lot of what's driving the rise in cases in Western Washington is people relaxing their vigilance and thinking, okay, I can get together with my friends and eat indoors in a restaurant and have a small crowd on a regular basis where we're all sitting around a small table
or sitting around
masks.
Watching the Seahawks or whatever. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I just want to say, no, you shouldn't be doing that. You know,
not yet.
Not yet.
Not safe.
Not yet.
Well, here in the university district from which we're broadcasting from, the frats had another outbreak of, over 100 people, being diagnosed. And, I mean, that's the second one they've had, you know, this year. Mm-hmm. And again, those are, I think they said there was 7, frats and sororities involved. And, these are people that I see when I'm walking here to work.
Yeah. I think the frat houses need to close and those kids need to go home, and do remote learning. But of course, their parents don't really want them. They're sick of having them there. Because they were there all summer. And then the frat houses opened up and welcomed them back. And I think that never should have happened. Of course, the University of Washington doesn't have any control over the frat houses. Those are independently operated by the fraternities and sororities themselves. So, that's a call that they should have made, I think.
Yep.
Those organizations.
And also this week, we are seeing here in Seattle the return of smoke, although not nearly as bad as a couple weeks ago, because the fires in California continue to burn.
Yep. Yeah, it was very foggy this morning, but also the air quality of the last few days has not been great. And the fires in California have been quite serious. Some areas of Santa Rosa have been evacuated for the second time in, I think, 3 years. There was a serious fire there that wiped out a number of homes a few years ago. And that's happening again with a fire that's going throughout the wine country of Napa and Sonoma County. And then there's another one north between Redding and Red Bluff. It's a very north end of Sacramento Valley that has wiped out at least 100,000 acres. So these are two of the largest fires in California state history. I think something like 4 of the 6 largest fires in their history have been this year. I mean, one of the larger ones is now under control, but, those two are still spreading and still almost not under control at all. Yeah. So we're starting to get smoke from those.
Don't we have another month or so before the fire season's over in California?
Traditionally, yes. In recent years, it's gone into December, so it could keep going for a while. It was literally 105 degrees in Northern California a couple of days ago. So very hot, very dry weather is just fueling those fires. And then when the wind kicks up, they spread very quickly.
Yeah, it used to be you didn't see triple digit temperatures in anywhere in California except Death Valley. But now that's becoming a feature of climate change on the West Coast.
Very much so. And, particularly in the Inland Empire where, you know, 3-4 million people live, that's San Bernardino, Riverside, that area. It's scorching hot now in the summer there. And even in LA, when you don't have wind coming off the water, which literally can be, you know, anywhere more than 5 miles inland, it can be really hot in the summer there. So it, and that's, you know, 15, 20 million people. That's a lot of people covered by that.
Yeah.
Well, looking forward to talking with you both again next week.
What could possibly happen between now and then?
Oh, nothing newsworthy, right?
No, it's highly unlikely. But we'll be here to cap it all.